Here's a fact about Benny Golson. In an 18-month stretch between 1955 and early 1957, he wrote 8 compositions that became jazz standards. Not tunes that got recorded a couple of times and found their ways onto albums, I mean standards. Whisper Not, I Remember Clifford, Killer Joe, Along Came Betty, Blues March, Are You Real, Five Spot After Dark, and this one, which you just heard. That's 8 tunes, 18 months, one composer from Philadelphia who was still largely unknown to the wider jazz public. The odds of even one of these compositions surviving 65 years is long. All 8 surviving is kind of a miracle. I'm Joanna Aline, and you're listening to The Standard Show on Biggie Radio out of Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, the show where we take one chart from the real book and spend an hour tracing every scar on it. Where the tune came from, who put it first to tape, what happened when it landed in the real book, and what 6 decades of musicians have done to it since. One song, 1 hour, the whole story. Tonight's song is Stablemates. Written in 1955, first recorded that same year by the Miles Davis Quintet with the then unknown John Coltrane on tenor saxophone, the recording opened Miles' debut prestige album. And here's the part that almost nobody knows. Benny Golson nearly didn't write it at all. He wrote it to avoid talking to his ex-wife. Tonight we're going into that story. We're going into the Van Gelder studio sessions in New Jersey in November of 1955. We're covering 4 essential versions, including a Cuban big band interpretation that sounds like maybe it shouldn't work, but it totally does. And in Act 6, we're going to do something we haven't done in this series yet. We're going to take a long look at the new real book. The first licensed competitor that came out of Sheer Music in 1988 and forced a real conversation about who gets to decide what the jazz canon looks like. That's a story that runs all the way through Stablemates. One note before we start. Stablemates is not a beginner tune. If you've ever called it at a session and watched half of the room quietly put their horns down and head to the bar, you know why now. The form is 36 bars, it's not 32. The changes move through multiple key centers in rapid succession, and there's a Latin feel built into the A sections that the real book doesn't really explain. All of that, it's coming, but first let's go to Philadelphia. Benny Golson was born on January 25th of 1929 in Philadelphia. North Philadelphia in that era was the kind of neighborhood where a kid with an ear and a little discipline could become a musician before the word musician had any particular weight attached to it. You just played. You showed up at jam sessions and you listened to whoever was better than you and tried to take something from them before they noticed. He started on piano at age 9. Ladies, tea parties, fashion shows, that kind of a circuit. By 14, he'd made a switch to tenor sax, and the reason for the switch was really specific. He saw Arnett Cobb play with Lionel Hampton's band at the Earl Theatre, and something rearranged himself in that understanding of what music is supposed to feel like. Cobb played with a physical ferocity and a melodic directness the piano didn't quite offer. The saxophone was the instrument that could do both. Here's where Golson's biography takes a turn that's almost too neat to be real. His closest friend and musical running buddy as a teenager was a kid from the same neighborhood named John Coltrane. They appeared in the same local bands, showed up in the same sessions on Columbus Avenue, and spent an enormous amount of time together trying to decode the harmonic logic of Charlie Parker. 2 teenagers in North Philadelphia in the late 40s, both of them eventually becoming 2 of the most significant figures in jazz history. The statistical improbability of this is something musicians have been shaking their heads over ever since. Golson has told a story about the 2 of them being turned away from a gig early in their careers. Put out politely, but definitively, not ready. Come back when you are. They walked home, and Golson's mother folded both of them into her arms and said, don't worry. One day both of you will be so good they won't be able to afford you. They were teenagers. They didn't believe her. Years later, at Newport, Coltrane stopped mid-warm-up and started laughing, reminded Golson of that moment, both of them on the same stage, unreachable. Before they got to Newport, there was the road. Howard University. There's no jazz program, where Golson played in the jazz exam for exactly 0 credit. Then a job with Bull Moose Jackson's R&B band, which is where he encountered pianist and arranger Ted Dameron. Dameron taught him how to think about a band as a single organism rather than a collection of soloists. That's where the composer was born inside the saxophone player. He moved through the major bands of the era, Lionel Hampton, Dizzy Gillespie, Earl Bostick, and it was on the road with Bostick in the fall of 1955, playing a dance in Wilmington, Delaware, that the tune we're discussing tonight came into existence. Golson's soon-to-be ex-wife was at the gig. She was there with her friends. This is a social situation that Golson had no interest in navigating during the intermission. He told her that he had an urgent commission due the next morning. No such commission existed. Found a quiet corner of the bandstand, opened a notebook, and started writing. The first 14 bars came out strange, not the wrong kind of strange, interesting strange. And he didn't trust it at first. He'd been writing tunes and handing them around for years, and most of them had disappeared into pockets and desk drawers, never to surface again. He thought this one might be what he later called demented. The form wasn't right by the standards of everything he knew. 32 bars was the template, had been since bebop codified it. This thing was pushing towards something different, and he wasn't sure if it was going to work. Over the next 2 nights on the road between sets and after gigs, he finished it. ABA form. The A sections are 14 bars each, 10 bars of swing followed by 4 bars of a Latin feel, a rhythmic shift built directly into the written structure. The bridge is 8 bars. That totals 36. He named it after a bar in Boston called Stables. He called it Stablemates, and then he gave it to John Coltrane, not expecting anything particular to happen. He'd given Coltrane tunes before. He'd given tunes to a lot of people before. Most of them ended up under a rug somewhere, but he was wrong about this one. The hard bop composers of the 1950s were working from a shared set of materials. 2-5-1 progressions. That's a blues form. 32 bar structures, usually AABA, song form. The vocabulary was largely agreed upon. What set Golson apart was his obsession with melodic intervals, with the space between one note and the next, and what that space does to the listener's ear. He talked about this directly in interviews across several decades. His argument is that it makes a melody memorable. What makes a melody rather than a collection of correct notes is interval logic. The tension built into the distance between pitch, the moment of the arrival after a leap, the way a descent can feel inevitable or surprising, depending entirely on what came before it. Listen to the Stablemates head. It descends and twists and lands somewhere you're not expecting, and then it doesn't resolve where you think it should, and then it does, and you feel it. That's not accidental. That's a composer who's thought very carefully about where the ear wants to go and how long to make it wait to get there. Golson put down his saxophone for several years in the 1970s to write for television. MASH, Mission Impossible, Mannix, the Partridge Family. When he came back and picked up the horn again, he played well into his 80s and even 90s. He died in September of 2024 at the age of 95. The 8 standards he wrote in 18 months between 55 and 57 are all still being played. Stablemates. And Benny Golson intended to keep it that way. John Hendricks, who's famous for writing vocal adaptations for most of the most intricate jazz compositions ever recorded, who put lyrics on Sing 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 and on Coltrane's Blues, approached Golson about writing words for stablemates. Golson turned him down. His reasoning was direct. "This is not the kind of tune for a lyric." He said the same thing to other people who asked. Nobody was going to put words to this one. So instead of lyrics, let's talk about musical language, because stablemates communicate something. It has personality and an emotional logic. It just does it entirely through intervals, rhythms, and harmony. Jazz musicians learn from the way other people learn to walk. The 32-bar structure, usually that song form, A-A-B-A, 8 bars per section, becomes so internalized that you just stop thinking about it. You can just feel the form. You know how a song works. You know where you are in the chorus, and you know when you're going upstairs or downstairs without counting the steps. Stablemates removes that feeling. The A sections are 14 bars each, not 8, not 16, 14, an odd irregular number that doesn't fit into that physical memory that players have developed over years of playing standard forms. Within each A section, the rhythm ground shifts. It's 10 of swing, 4 of Latin, a momentum change that's written into the composition itself. The bridge is 8 bars, so now we're 36, and the trap, the place where even experienced musicians get lost, is at the top of the form. When you finish the second A section and go back to the beginning for another chorus, there's no bridge separating the end of one chorus from the start of the next. Two consecutive A sections with nothing in between. Players who are holding the melody in their heads to track the form will find themselves in the middle of what feels like an identical phrase to the one you just played, and then suddenly you don't know if you've counted it wrong, and the band is either with you or it isn't. Drummer and educator Todd Bishop has written stablemates can be revealing for a drummer, which is a polite way of saying that it will find your weaknesses. Golson himself described it as a tune that moves around quite a bit. That's what 36 bars does to people who spent their careers thinking in 32. These changes are really dense, and they move quickly through multiple key areas. The A sections are built on a series of 2-5 progressions that don't settle into any single tonal center for long. They shift chromatically. Small half-step movements between key areas that Golson favored throughout his writing. The effect is a constant sense of motion, a harmonic ground passing underfoot that makes the brief moments of resolution feel really hard-earned. There is a genuine debate amongst musicians about the opening chord. The Miles Davis recording and the Golson's own 1958 recording approach the first bar differently. One version opens with a dominant seventh chord, the other approaches it as a minor chord. They both work. Both have legitimate claims to authority. We'll spend more time on that when we get to the real book, because the chart is at the center of this problem. What the harmonic density means for improvisation, Stablemates, is an intermediate to advanced standard. You need to be able to navigate 2-5 chains and keys that move quickly away from each other. You need to hold the form in your head without the anchor of that 32-bar structure. And you need to engage with the Latin feel, not just like as a small stylistic gesture, but as rhythmic reality. And it changes how you phrase. None of that is on the chart. All of that is in the recordings. That tension is exactly what we're going to dig into now. John Coltrane took Golson's lead sheet and gave it to Miles sometime in the fall of 1955. The Miles Davis Quintet was brand new, assembled after Miles's celebrated set at the Newport Jazz Festival that July, where a muted trumpet reading of Round Midnight had stopped the crowd cold. Columbia Records producer George Avakian had approached him at Newport about a major label deal. Miles was still contractually bound to Bob Weinstock's Prestige Records. The deal was struck. Finish the Prestige obligation, then Columbia. The quintet was Miles Davis on trumpet, John Coltrane on tenor, Red Garland on the piano, and Paul Chambers on the bass, Philly Joe Jones on the drums. Coltrane at this point is an unknown. I'm not just saying he's underrated, he's an unknown. A critic at the time described the new quintet as a wispy trumpet player, an out-of-tune tenor, a cocktail pianist, a teenage bassist, and an over-loud drummer. I love that, right? The out-of-tune tenor was John Coltrane. The teenage bassist was Paul Chambers, who was 19 years old, who would become one of the greatest bassists in the history of music. Criticism does age badly. The session was held at Rudy Van Gelder's studio in Hackensack, New Jersey on November 16th of 55. Van Gelder's setup at this point was his parents' house, a converted living room with high ceilings that gave his recordings a particular acoustic quality, warm but present, wide but defined. Engineers have been attempting to reverse engineer what he was doing with microphone placement for 60 years, and nobody has fully cracked it. Prestige under Bob Weinstock recorded the way you'd record a club gig. No rehearsal, no overdubs. Call the tune, count it off, play it. If the take worked, you moved on. Miles ran his sessions this way by choice. He wanted the spontaneity and the pressure of live performance captured on tape, not the polished reconstruction of a studio. Stablemates got at most 2 takes. The version that appeared on the album was one that worked. The record opens with the melody stated in unison. Miles on muted trumpet, Coltrane on tenor, playing that angular, twisting theme together. It sounds precise and a little dangerous, like two people running at exactly the same speed towards the same uncertain destination. Miles takes the first solo, space and muted, every note chosen, and Coltrane follows, and you can already hear the density that would define his mature style beginning to develop. Garland plays the solo with the directness and the swing that made him perfect for the band. Chambers, Philly Joe Jones, holding down the whole thing with a forward momentum that never lets up. Miles, on hearing the lead sheet, reportedly told Coltrane, "What were you smoking when you wrote that? meaning it as a compliment, and the tune went into the book. Golson found out after the fact, ran into Coltrane somewhere, and Coltrane greeted him with, "You know that tune you gave me? We recorded it." Golson's response in his own telling, "Miles recorded my tune?" He said he was levitating, and then something he'd been waiting for years happened. Musicians who had been politely ignoring his composition suddenly started calling and asking him if he had more. The tunes that had ended up in drawers and under rugs suddenly had value. One Miles Davis recording, and the whole calculus changed. Stablemates is published through IBBOB Music, Inc., and that's Golson's own publishing entity, with distribution through Hal Leonard. Golson was notably protective of his catalog. He refused to authorize lyric adaptations. Hendrick was turned down. And when Quincy Jones eventually wrote the lyrics for Killer Joe's, there was a specific exemption. Stablemates never got one of those. The rights have stayed close to Golson and his estate throughout his life. He died in September 24, but the catalog remains active. The album is called Miles, the new Miles Davis Quintet, Prestige Records, April 1956. It opens with Stablemates. That sequence is not incidental. Leading with an unknown composition by an unknown composer at that time is a statement. The band has something new, and they're going to say it on their own terms, not yours. By the early 1950s, Miles' career had been derailed by addiction. He'd spent several years rebuilding, checking himself into his father's farm in East St. Louis, quitting cold turkey, relearning what it meant to practice with intention. By 1955, he was back, and the Newport performance announced it to anybody who hadn't been paying attention. The quintet he built in the aftermath was the instrument he needed. His gift as a band leader was never about hiring the most famous people. It was about hiring the right people for the specific sound that he was hearing, even when those people weren't yet famous. Coltrane was raw and not yet formed. Chambers, 19 years old. But Miles heard something in each of them. He wanted density from Coltrane. He wanted the lyrical directness of Garland's Golden Touch. He wanted Philly Joe's slightly clipped, dry cymbal beat, which made everything swing just a degree harder than it should have. He wanted Chambers' deep, woody bass sound as that foundation that didn't draw attention to itself. The tempo is medium swing, not racing. The urgency comes from underneath, from the rhythm section, rather than from the pace. Philly Joe Jones plays with a restraint that creates tension without release. Miles' solo is built on space as much as on notes, long gaps between phrases, muted tones that sit at the border between a human voice and a brass instrument. When he plays, you lean towards the speaker, and when he doesn't, you wait. Coltrane's solo is where you can hear the future assembling itself. He's not yet playing the dense intervallic cascades that would define his work on Giant Steps only 3 years later, but the tendency for that is there. He's reaching for harmonic places that the changes themselves don't strictly authorize, and it's doing it with a physical commitment that makes the whole thing sound inevitable, even when it isn't. Red Garland's piano solo is the relief valve in the middle of the track, swinging, clear-toned, direct, block chords, and single-note lines alternating with the ease of someone who's played music since birth. Chambers on the bass is, as always, the spine of the arrangement. 19 years old, and he sounds ageless. One technical note for listeners who go looking for this recording, there's a long-running question about the opening chord of Stablemates on this track, whether it matches Golson's own later recording or departs from it. The departure is real and has consequences for every musician who learned this tune from this album rather than from Golson's 58 version. You are listening to The Standard Show on Big E Radio. That's 60 minutes every week on one jazz standard, from the first note to the real book. And I'm Joanne Aileen, broadcasting out of Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. If you've got a version of Stablemates you think belongs in this conversation, or standard that you would like me to talk about, reach out. It is www.the-standard-show.com. Now, let's talk about what some other musicians did with this. 3 years after Miles recorded it, Golson finally put down his own version of the tune, and that changed his career. The album was Benny Golson and the Philadelphians, and the personnel was deliberately, pointedly all Philly. Golson on tenor, Lee Morgan on trumpet, Ray Bryant on piano, and Percy Heath on the bass, and still that Philly Joe Jones on drums. This is not a casual lineup. Morgan was arguably the most exciting young trumpet player in jazz at that moment. Bryant was also an enormously gifted pianist who never got quite the recognition that he deserved. Heath was the anchor of the MJQ's rhythm section. There are two versions of the album, a regular take and an extended 8-minute version that lets Golson and Morgan stretch out over the changes in a way that the Miles recording doesn't permit. The extended take is the extraordinary take. These are two musicians who grew up in the same city, learned from the same teachers, absorbed the same musical vocabulary. When they trade solos over stablemates, the fluency between them is not the fluency of two jazz musicians playing a repertoire they shared. It's the fluency of people who know each other's musical instincts at a level below conscious thought. This is also the recording that settles, or it begins to settle, the chord question. Golson's own approach to the opening bar is audibly different than Miles. If you want to know what the composer intended, this is where you start. Bag Meets West is one of the best small group jazz recordings of the 1960s, and it's really consistently undersold. Mill Jackson on vibraphone, Wes Montgomery on guitar, Wynton Kelly on piano, Sam Jones on bass, Philly Joe Jones on drums. The session was recorded in late 61 and released in 62 on Riverside. Their version of Stablemates is a case study in how a tune changes when you put it in completely different hands. Montgomery plays the melody in octaves. That's his signature technique, developed because he practiced late at night in an apartment with thin walls and he couldn't use a pick. The octave sound gives his guitar warmth and orchestral weight that makes the angular Golson theme sound counterintuitively intimate. Jackson on vibraphone brings a blues depth to the solos that strips the academic complexity out of the changes and makes the tune feel really loose and conversational. Worth noting that Wes Montgomery was entirely self-taught. He learned jazz from records and he did it by ear without formal training. His engagement with Stablemates came from listening, not from reading a chart, and he probably never opened a real book. By the time the bootleg edition was circulating in 75, he'd been dead for 7 years. His relationship to this music was entirely oral and aural. That matters when we get to the standardization question later. In 1988, bassist and educator Chuck Scheer published the first volume of the New Real Book through Scheer Music in Petaluma, California. The difference from the Berkeley bootleg was fundamental. Scheer contacted composers directly. He asked permission to include their tunes, and then he paid them royalties. He had the composers review and correct the transcriptions of their own music. When a chart appears in the New Real Book, it appeared with the composer's knowledge and, in many cases, with the composer's corrections to the errors that had been circulating in the bootleg for years. Benny Golson's music appears in the New Real Book, and his catalog was large enough and important enough that Scheer wanted multiple tunes. When Golson's charts appeared in the licensed edition, for the first time, what was on the page had been improved by the person who wrote the music. And here's where the chord question comes back. The bootleg real book chart for Stablemates was transcribed from the Miles Davis recording, the 56 Prestige session. The recording approaches the opening bar in a specific way, but Golson's own 1958 recording approaches it differently. For musicians who learn Stablemates from the bootleg real book, the Miles version is the correct version by default, not because anyone decided it was correct, but because it was the version that got transcribed. the new Real Book version, supervised by the composer rather than by just anonymous students, is different. It's closer to what Golson intended. The Sheer Music, Benny Golson Songbook, a separate publication that came out of the same licensing philosophy, goes further, providing Golson's own lead sheets for his major compositions, including Stablemates. Musicians who know that book play the opening chord differently from musicians who learned from the bootleg. Neither version is objectively wrong, but one of them is what the composer wrote. And that's what the new Real Book really changed. It introduced the concept of an authoritative... And that is what the Real Book changed. It introduced the concept of an authorial authority back into a situation where the bootleg had removed it entirely. When you use a chart from the bootleg, you're playing someone else's version of a recording of a song. When you use a chart from the new Real Book, you're playing something closer to the song as the composer understood it. Those aren't the same thing. For most tunes, the difference is really small. For Stablemates, where the opening chord is a genuine part of interpretive disagreement, it really matters. What the chart doesn't tell you is that there's a stop time bar at bar 10 of each A section. These are written in Golson's own recordings. There's a moment where the rhythm just cuts out briefly before resuming, and they are one of the most distinctive features of the tune on the record. They're not really noted in most available charts. At jam sessions, where typically they are dropped out during solos and restored for the head going in and out. If you learn Stablemates from a chart without hearing the recordings, you might play through the whole tune without ever stopping, and for years, without knowing where the stops are supposed to be. Convention at sessions, play the head as written, including stops and the Latin feel. Solo over straight swing changes. Come back for the head out with stops and the Latin feel again. None of that is in the Real Book, and all of it is in the recordings.
Thank you.
Paul Chambers recorded Stable Meats the same years as Miles' version came out, 1956, and also on a session with Coltrane. The album was Chambers' music on Blue Note, and the significance of this version is partly historical and part musical. Historical, it means that in 1956, jazz musicians had two authoritative recordings of Stable Meats with slightly different approaches to the opening chord, and they were released essentially simultaneously. From the very beginning, there is no single consensus on the version. Musical, Chambers, as a leader rather than a sideman, takes liberties with the arrangements that Miles' version can't permit. The session breathes just a little differently. And Coltrane, on his second recorded version of the same tune in the same year, is already pushing further into the harmonic territory he'd been circling on the Prestige date. I love that I have this one on the list. This is Chilean-born saxophonist and bandleader Raul Gutierrez, who founded the Arazu Big Band in Munich in 1981 and has spent four decades bringing Afro-Cuban and American jazz, recorded Stable Meats for a Dizzy Gillespie tribute album called A La Palladium, the music of Dizzy Gillespie in Latin. The arrangement is by Horacio Gonzalez. Why does Stable Meats appear on a Dizzy Gillespie tribute album? Because Dizzy Gillespie was one of the first band leaders to commission a big band arrangement of the tune. In 1957, as part of the U.S. State Department tour, the famous Jazz Ambassadors program, Gillespie asked Golson to write a chart for his orchestra. Stable Meats went into that book. Including it in a Dizzy tribute is historically coherent. What Gutierrez does with it is something else. This big band locks into the Latin feel that Golson built into the A sections, those four bars of Latin groove that are part of the rhythm structure, and it expands it outward until the whole tune exists inside an Afro-Cuban rhythmic framework. The clave pattern underneath the angular Golson melody creates a friction that shouldn't really work, but it totally does. That opening theme, which already sounds sideways when you play it over straight swing, gains a new kind of logic over that mambo feel. The strangeness of the melody stops sounding like a harmonic difficulty and starts sounding like an intentional syncopation. 3 minutes, 22 seconds, worth every second. Thank you. is Music, 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 and they're a Swedish piano trio from Gothenburg, led by Fabian Kallerdahl on the piano and Joseph Kallerdahl on bass, Michael Edlund on the drums. The version of Stablemates is on their 2022 album called Good Look. It's the second track. This album is described as adorable standards rearranged and tampered with, alongside originals wrapped in what fans call classic MMM package. Tight, naive, and groove forward. Thank you. This recording is from 2021. That's Peyton on the trumpet, Cohen on piano, Russell Hall on the bass, and Kyle Poole on the drums. It was recorded for Emmett Cohen's Live from Emmett's Place series during the pandemic. Peyton gives the quartet a lot of time and a lot of room on this one. The head, it took me a second to even figure out what tune it is, but I really like it. Let me know if you do too. Thank you. Benny Golson once said that he thought this tune was demented. He first called it the Weird Tune before it became Stablemates. He said it to himself, sitting on a bandstand in Wilmington, trying to look busy. 14 bars instead of 12 or 16. A Latin feel dropped into the middle of a swing tune. A form that circles back on itself without warning, and he almost threw it out. What he couldn't have known, what nobody could have known on that bandstand in 55, is that demented parts are exactly why the tune lasted. The irregular form keeps musicians on their feet. The competing chord interpretations give every player a small editorial decision to make at bar one. The Latin feel built into the A sections makes the Cuban big band version feel like a discovery more than an imposition. The stop time hits that never make it into the charts have to be learned from records, which means every musician who plays Stablemates well has spent time with the Golson recording, which means Golson's voice is in the room even when he isn't. The new reel books change something about this tune's relationship to the page. It introduced the composer's own understanding of his music back into a situation where the bootleg had quietly replaced it with a transcription. That's worth something. The argument that two versions are close enough not to matter is the same argument that says the stops at bar 10 don't matter, and that the Latin feel doesn't matter, and the specific articulation of the melody doesn't matter. At some point, the accumulation of it doesn't matter becomes a different tune entirely. Stablemates is not a tune that forgives imprecision. It finds those cracks, and that's what 36 bars does to you. This has been The Standard Show, and this week's standard was Stablemates. I'm Joanna Aline on Big E Radio from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. You can always reach me at the-standard-show.com. You can request a standard, send a version, tell us what you've been woodshedding. Next week, I'm going somewhere where I haven't been yet in this series, but more on that soon. But let me leave you with Emmett Coleman live with Nicholas Payton. You can hear them storming away underneath me, and that's where I'm going to let them play us out. Thanks so much for taking the time to listen to another standard on another week. We'll see you next week.
Hey there, music lovers. Did you know that getting licensed to share music online is not just the right thing to do? It's also super important for supporting creators and the music industry. That's why we're proud to be licensed by SOCAN, a copyright collective that grants licenses for online music broadcasts in Canada. By getting licensed through SOCAN, you ensure that every beat, every note, and every melody that you play is compliant and fair to the creators. Join us in supporting the music community. Visit SOCAN's website at www.socan.com and get your web radio, podcast, or any other use of online music licensed today. Let's stream beautiful music together, legally and ethically. SOCAN. Music. People. Connected.